This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, of course. It works on Zoom. There's no delay. The rhythm is perfect.
Hey. And I think I expressed this last time. So I'm just going to talk normally and you do the beat.
Okay.
You'll be on beat, right?
I will be on beat. Here I go.
And I'll be
not.
And
it's on Zoom. It's over a distance. Two different
general
continents.
Way of being. Since
it's
I'm like a
continent.
I'm very
two
much a Karen, right? I'm
continent.
Not going to be on beat.
Canada,
we're not going to see
USA.
Me.
USA.
Dance.
I was homeschooled.
Well,
I don't
that's
know what
not
to
gonna
say.
That's not going to happen. I will have a white wine with me while I speak
white
to the manager.
Wine is great.
That's just what
welcome.
My shit is about. Welcome back.
Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce.
Oh my God. Welcome everyone. Welcome young people. Welcome old people. Welcome cringe wine moms. We are here yet again.
We're here for your cringe and we're here for your binge too. It's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. Why was that not the tagline?
Boom, boom, boom.
Cringe while
that
you
was
binge.
Amazing.
Yes. Oh, sorry. I should keep this thing playing.
Okay, so this is, I've got both mics now and I can do, okay, but we'll figure that out later.
Are you recording your vocal track? I just want to be very clear.
Jesus, I've been recording for 8 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, and I am talking to Jesus because I assume you're close with him.
Jesus?
Right now.
I've been recording for 8 minutes. It's the sequel to Are You There, God? It's me, Alice. Jesus, I've been recording for 8 minutes. Here we go.
I feel like you're like the guy in Elf with Jesus. Like
which one?
If you were like in church and they were like, Jesus is going to make an appearance, you'd be like, I know him.
Okay. So when you said you're like the guy in Elf, you mean you're like Elf in Elf. You could just say you're like Elf in Elf. You're not like the guy in Elf.
Yeah. Does anybody know what that like sounds like if I said that? If I was like, you're like Elf in Elf. It's weird. It sounds like a weird thing.
You would space it out a little bit. By the way,
it sounds like an ad roll.
I want to take a second, and we said at the end of the last episode covering 401 and 402, but I just want to say grace for our new editor and producer, Grace Harper. Is going to be cutting up and editing all the bad stuff out this season. And she did such a bang-up job.
How'd you get Grace Harper? How'd you get that? How'd you get Grace?
Oh, gosh. I mean, negotiations were fierce. It was a proxy battle. Mm-hmm. A big old bidding war. But we got her, and she's doing fantastic. So thank you to Grace. And we're all just doing our best here on the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. And we're covering episodes 403 and 404. We're doing two in a row, again, together as they are releasing them. We're doing this at an interesting time, Alice, because it is the March.
Russia.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to talk about that? You know how many tweets I've been tagged on in the last week that said, actually, the president of the Ukraine, who used to be an actor and a comedian himself, Zelensky, yes.
Uh-huh.
He was the voice in the Ukrainian dub of Paddington. So,
God, I wish I was tagged in as many tweets as you are. I wish I had the social media reach that you have.
It's not true. You know, you have even further than I do if we want to talk numbers.
I definitely don't.
Do you really not think that?
I definitely don't. Oh, for sure. You want to tweet? Let's both tweet something right now. Like something that, and we both tweet the exact same statement and see who gets more traction. Oh, no question. Yours would blow up instantly and mine would be like a couple guys named Dave from like Kansas that are like, you're hot.
Where's your feet?
Like, where's your feet? Well, no, they're on the bottom of my legs.
Enough
Todd,
of the tweets.
Because I
more
can't
the feet.
Afford to lose these two fans.
Are you on WikiFeet?
I am.
Okay, good
I got
for
a pretty
you.
High rating on WikiFeet. I wish you could monetize that, but
I mean, you can.
I feel like I come across like very desperate for fame a lot of the time when I talk on this show, and I really want to set the record straight. That is exactly what I am.
Yeah, kidding. I mean, listen, but it's working. You're starring now in your second of two TV shows about aliens in Canada. You've appeared in feature films. You've been in television for...
Oh, and they're finally submitting me for an Emmy this year.
Finally.
They didn't do it last year.
Are they actually?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, good for you. You know who's another Emmy winner? Alex Borstein.
Well, I didn't say I'm an Emmy winner. Just said they're submitting
you know
me for noms.
You know who else was submitted for an Emmy
That's
nomination?
True. That's a really good point.
Alex Borstein. Yeah.
That's right.
Wait,
That's
can
true.
You talk? Can you talk about this at all?
Yes.
You can?
Yeah, I can totally talk about it because that episode has aired.
Great.
So I'm good.
So our own Susie Meyerson stopped by a little bit up north to see Alice on the set of Resident Alien. Was she in multiple episodes of your television
She's
show?
She's only in one this season.
She's in one this
so
far. Season. How was your
so
experience
far. I have to say
working,
so far because
so far.
It's a spoily.
Okay. Well, how was your experience working with Alex on the show?
So I was like, obviously beside myself.
Sure.
But like, I was like, I didn't know if I should tell her that I have a Maisel podcast, like, because that seems like the lamest thing you could, you know. It's like, hey, coworker, I want to be inside your skin. So she's friends with Chris Sheridan because Chris was a producer writer on Family Guy for, you know, 65 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so good friends with Chris Sheridan. And when this role was about to be cast, it was like, we need somebody who could, it was like they needed somebody who could improvise, play a love interest for Alan's Harry, and then also play Harry. Like, I don't know if you saw the episode, but in the episode, he has a limited power to be able to like impersonate people. And Carlin, the character she plays, is one of the people that who's he like replicates her appearance. And so she had to be Alan Tudyk's Harry for some of the scenes.
That's so fun.
And she was great. She was incredible. And, you know, they didn't do any rehearsal with her. Like, you'd think, okay, they work on like vocal affectations together with a coach. No. Chris was like, do you want to sit down, like do an appointment with Alan? Do you want to meet on Zoom? How do you want to do this? And she just goes, nah, I think I got it.
Pro.
And then she showed up to set and was amazing.
All pro. Yeah. Dear Lord.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's funny you said, because Sheridan's from Family Guy, as his Borstein would know, people would know her as the voice of Lois on that show. What you don't realize about people's careers, as we talk about Borstein on this show, winning Emmys, or doing a guest spot on Resident Alien, or Mila Kunis's film career and how she's blown up in the last decade, they're still doing Family Guy at the same time. All the while this is happening, they're still yeah. picking up, you know, 80K, probably north of that, an episode.
Oh, yeah.
For some voice work, and good for them. What a nice little situation.
You know what? Love that for them.
I love that for them, too. SAG minimums, at least.
Anyway, Borstein was amazing. She was, you know...
And you sent me a great little picture of y'all together.
You know, I loved working with her because... many reasons, you know, but she just had this, like, when you're the guest star on a show, there's this thing, no matter, you know, there's this thing like, okay, how are people going to treat you? You're coming in as the guest and you're like, you're not one of the gang. They all have these in jokes together. They all have this kind of close knit community and you're the guest, you know? And I always try really hard to take care of the guest stars that are at least tangential to my character because I've been in that spot before. But with Borstein, I was like, yeah, but you're Alex Borstein. So you're going to be big timing us. And she really wasn't, you know, she was kind of like, she was really, really observant. Like she was watching us interact and like very, she was like a little sponge. And it made me really nervous because I was like, I need to be for, you know, like I wanted her to like me. So, and then when she rapped, she came up to me and she's like, I don't like you.
Oh God.
You know? And so.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. Yeah. Shit. It didn't. She said, I just needed to say, I don't like you. No, she was fantastic. She was great.
That's
so
great.
She was really nice to me and I feel like we have a rapport now.
That's lovely.
I don't know. I think somebody told her that I had a Maisel podcast and she was like, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, that would be my reaction too.
Yep.
If someone said, I have a podcast about something you did.
I have a Kevin T. Porter podcast.
Oh, okay. Which, okay. By the way, not much to talk about on that thing, first of
hey,
all.
Hey, pretend you are telling me that you have an Alice Wetterlund podcast.
Oh, you know, and it's been so great working with you. And actually, this is kind of silly, but I do have a podcast about you that I started with a friend of mine where we just kind of talk about your work and stuff.
It's about fucking time.
Oh, you're into it. Oh, this is great.
Yes.
Oh,
I can't believe I've been in this business for 15, 20 years. How long does it take to get my own podcast? Bunch of old nerds on the internet can't get their shit together to make a weird, creepy podcast about me.
Well, we would love if you came on and did an interview with us.
Oh, fuck no.
Oh, okay.
That would destroy the whole thing.
Hey.
Are you kidding me? No, I have shit to do.
Shout out to Connor Ratliff from
Always
our HeadGum brother with his show Dead Eyes. Do you know the premise of this show? The show Dead Eyes, it's about how he was fired from the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
Oh, right.
Back in like 1999 or 2000.
Okay, this is something I've heard of.
And this is relevant too because he plays Chester on Maisel.
Yes.
And he's in one of the episodes we're talking about today. And the whole thing, he got fired by Tom Hanks and he's been doing this show for 3 seasons. And as of now, I believe this will come out the same week so we can cross promote it. He booked Tom. Tom Hanks is coming for real on his podcast and saying like, yeah, here's why I fired you. Isn't that great?
Oh my God.
So good for him.
Oh my God.
Big win for Chester.
I heard rave reviews of his show and that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, he's had a very impressive guest roster. And so Alice and I decided to zag and say no guest on season 4 of Maisel Goys.
Because we don't want to have to, you know, compete because we would blow him out of the water, I'm imagining, but I don't want to have to do that for
him. I'd rather not.
You know?
No.
No.
Let's give him a little space to shine.
Give him his little spaces.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, I'm so glad you had a nice time. By the way, you are the second co-host I've had that's met Alex Borstein and not me because I believe Demi did meet her when he was working at Midnight like 5 or 6 years ago. No, more than that. 6 or 7 years ago.
Hurtful.
Maybe 7 or 8 years ago. Jesus. But yes. So one day, fingers crossed. Yeah. Probably not. I don't know the scenario.
See what happens with Ukraine.
I mean, fingers crossed I meet Alex Borstein. But first, let's check in with Zelensky and Sean Penn and see what's going on.
Ugh, Sean Pencil Dick. I hate him.
Ooh, okay.
So glad he's finally on the cancellation train.
Choo-choo.
Chew fucking chew, baby.
Do you want to talk about episodes 403 and 404?
No, I want to talk about Sean fucking Penn.
Okay, well,
I'm just kidding.
Sean
Let's do
Penn
it.
Is not Let's in this it. Episode of Maisel.
And good riddance.
When you watch these, by the way, Alice, how do you watch them? Do you do one at a time? Do you do it on the TV, on the computer? Are you on
two
your phone?
Two at a time.
You do two at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, like we're doing.
Yes. Well, I didn't know if you had a specific ritual. You got your little snacks or something.
I did have snacks last night. I watched them last night. It was a rewatch, though, just to refresh, because I watched them right away after our last show.
Oh, lovely.
And then, I did have some snacks. I've been making these keto sunflower butter cups in my fridge here.
Oh, that sounds so good. Remember when we used to make snacks for each other and bring them over?
Oh, my God. Nachos that we had were just, I was so I had put such love into those nachos.
I miss those nachos, man, from the Albertsons right across the corner. Mm. Woo. Oh, baby. Well, before we go on a nostalgia trip of our own, it's time to talk about the episodes. This is episodes 403 and 404. I had trouble getting that out. 403, Everything is Belmore, the Amazon Prime synopsis. Midge runs into an old friend at work. Susie finds out she has a close friend. Abe's job gets personal. Rose's matchmaking business draws attention. 404, Interesting People on Christopher Street is the name of this one. Midge establishes new rules, like Dua Lipa. That's not part of it. I added that. Susie gets a leg up from old friends. Abe has more in common with Asher than he thought. And once again, it's time for our classic segment called
12 o'clock rock. We're gonna
pop
around
the culture
tonight.
Just right at the top of the range. Right at the top of the range where we take every pop culture reference in these two episodes and put them together in a supercut.
Is
Aristotle this and Aristotle that.
Jackie met Babe Ruth.
She's not the bippity-boppity-chee-chee.
She's no Judy Garland.
Hold on to your Great Gatsby's, guys.
Both of Groucho's parents are dead.
She's like Houdini.
I may not be Mary Martin or Jessica Tandy, but...
Oscar Wilde.
Eugene O'Neill, Aaron Copland, Tarzan, Josephine Baker.
With that Louise Brooks haircut,
this is Dior, too.
Dorothy Parker never forgave you.
Dorothy Parker never knew who I was.
Dorothy Parker had a crush on you.
2 years ago, you directed Vertigo.
Basically, you're walking in with the Lawrence Welk singers.
Last year, it was North by Northwest.
You don't need the Martha Graham, this whole thing, right?
Sacco and Vincetti had the best in the business, too.
So let me ask you, Mr. Hitchcock.
I used to lift weights with Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzan himself.
The Portrait of Warren G. Harding.
What's up, Doc? That's all, folks.
You started the Looney Tunes thing.
All right. So two of those references came from the subjects of the fictional Gordon Ford Show. This is a talk show that we see on the television as Susie is watching it.
Very interested in this.
In the Maisel's living room. Gordon Ford is not a guy that exists, but he is played by the actor Reed Scott, who people may know as Dan Egan from Veep. And also from the Venom franchise.
I recognized his voice.
Of course, I was like, who is that guy?
But I couldn't zoom in.
So he's fictional. The people he's interviewing are not. He interviews Groucho Marx and Alfred Hitchcock on that show. My guess, Alice, is that they're setting us up for some sort of situation in which Midge either goes on the show and kills or bombs, but that their paths intersect in some way.
Yeah. What's the over-under on that?
I mean, now, unfortunately, this is a phrase I use. What's the over-under on that? But I literally don't know what it means enough to be
able
to. I
love to say it. Love to not know what it means.
Yes.
Please never find out.
And I'm going to continue to operate.
Me too.
In ignorance with that.
Same TBH.
Other pop culture references, talking about, of course, Dorothy Parker gets name-checked a couple times of the titular Dorothy Parker Drank Here Productions, the Paladino's production company. They're kind of North Star, I think, with a lot of this. Each episode of TV they make, a sort of Algonquin table of their own. And a lot of lists of names and yelling, as Daniel likes to do. And Jason Alexander.
Yep.
It's hard, man, because I think Jason Alexander is a technically excellent actor.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, when he does yell, it does remind you of Costanza just because that pitch and register
is such a trigger
for the most iconic.
I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's being with Garrett and just the resemblance. But ever since I've been with Garrett, Jason Alexander can get it so hard from me. And in this episode, I was like, Rose, make your move.
Yes.
Because Abe was like, We'll talk about it later, but yeah.
Well, this is maybe a good segue into sort of Paladinoisms as they exist on this show. And these two episodes are full of a lot of them that listeners have pointed out, other people have pointed out. Joanna Robinson, a friend of mine over at The Ringer, her and Mallory Rubin did a great episode on just kind of a mid-season check-in on Maisel so far. And so they made a lot of interesting points if people want to check out those episodes. Of their own podcast. Or if you want to hear a less educated but kind of funnier, probably not that much funnier version of it, you can listen to Maisel Goys as well. But yes, one of the things that seems to be popping up in this season is...
Listen to The Ringer if you want some stuff that's not us.
That was beautiful. Thank you. I found there to be a lot of oddly recycled plots from... specifically Gilmore Girls over these two episodes. So someone writing a very mean review of a performance piece by someone else and then getting a lot of vitriol in response to that. Does that strike you as familiar at all?
Yes. That's what Rory did.
Rory did this in the, I want to say, season 4 episode Die Jerk, in which she is very unkind. It's either a dance or a play that she reviews for the Yale School paper. And everyone hates her because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, in Maisel, over these episodes, we see the same thing happening to Abe. He writes a very unkind review of a family friend's play for The Village Voice.
Yeah.
At first, he tries to tweet it out and just say, like, your mother would like it, which is pretty apt. But then does the full-on scathing takedown.
Right.
Which even a listener in our Q&A pointed out, why didn't he just say, oh, I know the person, I probably ethically can't review this. It's an old family friend.
It's so, yeah, it's, yeah, maybe, do you think maybe in like 1960 there wasn't that?
No, there was no ethics in like, journalism.
There was no ethics.
That didn't happen until the 2000s.
It was
which
Watergate.
There became ethics in gaming journalism. And then it was Watergate that did it for the rest of it too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because, yeah, that is a huge plot hole. Like, why would that? And then I would say props to the actor who plays Abe. He's obviously
talking about the Shalhoub, lubing it up.
Yeah, Tony Shalhoub, obviously newcomer to entertainment, but that's why I didn't know his name. But he really handled this well. Like, it was wonderful to watch him move through the paces of like saying the show was, because like I think if you're a I don't know, seasoned television watcher, but at least sort of a Sherman Palladino watcher, you'll know from the get that he has to write a review and he's going to a play of the person that he knows, he's going to hate it. Like, that to me was teed up from the beginning. And I thought I thought the moment that he fell into the rant, the obvious rant that he has to do where he's like, it's so terrible. I thought that was wonderful. I thought the way that he tried to avoid it with the tweet, it's great. Now it's fine. I got to go. I don't know. I thought that was all pretty cute and well done.
Yeah. It's something, though, that did strike me, like you were saying, where you can see the dots being connected for a setup.
Yeah. It was all over the place. You could see the strings on Peter Pan flying around.
It's so interesting for shows like this that are developed in this fully new infrastructure. A show like this just simply couldn't exist in this way 15 or 25 years ago, where it's like funded by Jeff Bezos. It's a 5-season joint, all the money in the world at their disposal, but still using sort of sitcom function and mechanisms for their storytelling, where that setup is like, Abe's got to write a review about a play, but he knows him, but he hates it.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be out of place on a very good episode of Roseanne, which the Palladinos worked on.
That's right.
Or at least Amy did. And so it's interesting to see it just in this like prestige clothing at the same time.
And I was thinking about the show in general, and it's starting to sort of, it ties into the conversation we had last week, but it does feel like more than ever, it's starting to become Gilmore Girls in prestige clothing, an episodic show, you know, like a less serialized thing that's more just like, it feels a little bit like, okay, we got a 4th season. Let's see, you know, like not like there's a plan.
Yeah. And that's what's so kind of confounding to me about it, Alice, is that I was thinking about this in particular while watching these two episodes, because the meta narrative for all the other ASP stuff is one of frustration or mitigation of vision. So with Gilmore Girls, yeah, they did it for 6 seasons, but they didn't do it for a 7th. So their vision was frustrated and ended prematurely. And then they got back together to do it, you know, 10 years later. But there was obviously maybe a little something missing in the magic to it. Bunheads was canceled early. So this is the first time, beginning, middle, and end, they get to execute and oversee a TV show from beginning, middle, to end, as long as they wanted it to go, with as much money as they wanted to have, with all the goodwill in the world at their disposal. After winning, you know, a dozen plus Emmys for season 1, I think some for season 2. Borsi won an Emmy, Brosnahan, Palladino won a couple herself. Luke Kirby won one for his performance, which
Lenny Bruce.
Which is why they bumped him up to a series regular in this season, even though he's only been in one episode so far, which is kind of odd. But that was the thing that really rung in my head, is like, oh, this is them not frustrated. I mean, the only thing that frustrated it was maybe COVID and they didn't get to travel a little bit in season 4. But as far as like, there's no external factor here that is kind of heading them off at the pass. There's no financial thing. And yet this is what they're choosing to do, was my thought with it. And I was a little, it kind of made me rethink how I thought about Palladino in the past, where I think I had a lot of benefit of doubt of, well, if she was able to do her thing, if there weren't all these forces at work, then this thing would have been better. But now seeing it play out where, you know, we're halfway through season 4, we got 4 more episodes to go this season and then 8 more next year and then we're done. It's like, oh, that's what it is? Because even midway in season 4, I'm still not quite understanding what the show's about.
Well,
in a big way,
a couple of things. Like, there is that thing we've talked about before about, like, I'm sure you know what the name of it is, but when a creator gets too much money, or when money is thrown at something and then it doesn't make it better, you know, and when they're constrained by money. We've talked about this a bunch before, mm-hmm. so I think you might either know what I'm talking about and can summarize, but I feel like there should be a name for it.
Well, a lot of people, I always call it kind of blank check syndrome, where...
Thank you. I knew you'd know the name. Look at you.
Well, there's a whole podcast that's predicated on this idea where this creator has done excellent work, and now someone has backed up the Brinks truck of like, okay, this was really successful. Do literally whatever you want.
Yeah.
With a huge budget.
Yeah.
And so Maisel, and sometimes those, as the podcast says, sometimes those checks clear and sometimes they bounce. Maisel is a big clear because it was such a reputation maker for Amazon Prime and for Paladino herself. And I mm-hmm. think her career went on an upswing. Not that it was in the dumps, but it went on an upswing ever since this show started.
Right. But it did what needed to be done, and now there's more. And I was also thinking, like, does she have PTSD?
From what?
Like, is Paladino, having so often had her vision truncated by outside forces and feeling like she's worked too hard to have it, you know, it's like that moment, like having been a showrunner on several shows that went that direction and had her dreams crushed that many times, do you think maybe she has PTSD? And so now it's like, she's afraid to like really pursue it. Or maybe it's Daniel. Maybe Daniel's the one. He's like,
no, do an impression. You know, like, you have it.
I want to write an episode.
Okay, yay! Daniel, you'll get the next script. Maybe we can co-write on it, Daniel.
Cereal? Can I have cereal?
Yes, we can have a little bit of the Honey Nut Cheerios if you're good.
Yum!
If you finish your draft in time, you can have
yum, 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 yay.
They did co-write both of these episodes, and then he directed 403 and she directed 404.
Yeah.
But yes, it is just interesting to see the blank check clearing in this way where this is absolutely what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
And what she wanted to do is kind of circle the drain and kind of spend some time over here and be so digressive in this way that feels like miscalculation to me.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest about it.
Well, I feel like these episodes were less messy than the first two, and I'm willing to suspend. Maybe it was just like sinking, that feeling of like getting into the hot bath and you're like, too hot, and now I'm sinking in and I'm like, okay, I know what to expect, you know? And I'm like, but I was less annoyed by these last two episodes.
But you did identify something well in which she's doing Gilmore rhythms in a much tighter infrastructure.
Right.
Whereas Gilmore, when it is so lackadaisical and sitcom-y, you also have to understand the landscape of television in 2000s era network days, in which there were 22 episodes. Mm-hmm. And you had to have 22 episodes of stories. And so, of course, there's going to be ones where they go to Martha's Vineyard and who cares? And there's going to be ones that don't go anywhere and who cares? Because that's just what it was. This is eight. This is less than half of that.
That's right.
And yet they're like, well, what if we spent a lot of time on this strip club, you know, or whatever. I mean, the strip club is probably more plot important than I'm giving it credit for.
I hope so, right? Like,
I think
so. I started to think it was when I saw New Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about when I say New Josh?
A New Josh.
New Josh? Do you know what I'm saying? Finally, a pop culture reference you don't know and I do. Well, I made it, but still.
Is this Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Santino Fontana?
Fuck off. All right, we're done. We're done now.
By the way, isn't he old Josh? He's the first Josh.
No, he's New Josh. Oh, you're right. He is the first Josh.
Yeah, he is. So Santino Fontana, who people may remember as the love interest on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Rachel Bloom's show.
Oh my God, he is.
On the CW. Also, they may know him from Broadway. They may know him from, of course, Frozen. He plays one of the primary characters. And in this show, in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, he's Boise, who's sort of the backstage manager of the strip club. And he hasn't sung yet, which is odd for a show that's almost a musical all the time.
He's got to have singing blue balls all the time.
Yeah, think about Shaloub. I mean, Shaloub probably has blue balls, loop balls, Shaloub balls for himself.
Balls.
But, you know, Joanna Robinson on that other podcast I was talking about, she was laying out an interesting prediction, which she hadn't watched beyond 404 either, which is that Midge might follow a track that the woman that the musical Gypsy is based on follows, where she starts stand up and by doing it in a strip club.
Right.
Or in a burlesque house or whatever, and then ascends to fame via that.
Right.
And of course, Amy Sherman Palladino in the past was attached to a remake of Gypsy written and directed by her and starring Melissa McCarthy. Right. Which I wish they would cast literally anyone
else. That was her To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right. Well, no, they wanted to do it as a movie. They wanted to do it as a movie musical. Oof. Which I don't know if you've heard, but those things are popular again.
Yeah.
Tick, Tick, Boom. In the Heights.
Yeah. In the Heights.
Encanto. West Side Story. Yeah. Bombing.
Not great. I feel like not a great sign for humanity when musicals start being popular again.
You're anti-musical, not a fan.
I'm not anti-musical. I mean, just like it's a canary in the coal mine of when culture really takes a dip into Nazism, you know? Fascism.
Oh, yeah.
Fascism is on the rise. Populism, authoritarianism on the rise. We see an uptick in musicals. I think that's proven out. I think that's borne out by historical
Listen,
fact.
I don't like Tom Holland.
Look, I don't love Tom Holland. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
Thank you.
I want to talk about... for another sort of Gilmore, this is an unfortunate Gilmore comparison, but to talk about the actor Brian Tarantino, who played Bootsy on Gilmore Girls, and of course played the gentleman who passes away in this show, Jackie, kind of Susie's right hand man at the Gaslight.
Yeah,
and the real life actor Brian Tarantino died. Back in 2019, so a while ago. But because production was delayed, they didn't get to pay proper tribute and respect to him until now, until this season. And it is very sad. The actor himself, I believe, died of an overdose. It was drug-related, how he went out. But in the show, they incorporate his death in a very classy, very elegant sort of way.
Right.
That reminded me of the way that they incorporated Edward Herman's death in the revival episodes.
Right, yeah.
Where across these two episodes, I'd say one of the more emotional and more salient points of interest for me was Susie's reaction to her finding out posthumously that he considered her a close friend.
Right.
That Jackie had this whole life outside of her that she finds out via his sister and this box of stuff. Which again is very, you know, when Richard Gilmore's mother dies, it's kind of like that too. All these revelations that come out, all going through her old stuff. But her speech at the funeral, I found to be very, very moving, and Alex Borstein gave great work for that. I do have that queued up, if you can hear it.
Please,
that's not how it should go. It's not how he should be remembered, or not remembered, because apparently no one remembered because nobody showed up, except four people. Four people to send you off. Where the fuck was everyone? A man dies, you show up at his funeral, right? This was Jackie. He never hurt anyone. He lived his life. He did nice things. He fixed up my shitty apartment. He put up curtains. He painted. He made stew. He built whatever the hell it was he built for the fucking Monsignor over there. Apparently no one gave a shit. No one noticed. Fuck, I live with the guy and I didn't notice. We slept very close. I mean, I knew personal things about the guy. You know, he snores. Certain foods did not agree with him. You kept the windows open on those nights. I knew his laundry day. I knew when he cut his hair, shit like that. But I never knew him. I never knew he fought in the war. I never knew he got a medal for bravery. I mean, they don't just hand those out. You gotta get shot or save somebody, or blow up a fucking tank. A medal is a big deal. He collected Bazooka Joe comics. He kept the little ticket stubs to the opera. He had a baseball signed by Babe Ruth. Can you fucking believe that? Jackie met Babe Ruth. I mean, he kept it in a shoebox like an asshole, but he had it. I mean, this guy lived a life, and I never knew any of this. I mean, it was just a minute ago I found out I was his friend. No, I'm sorry, one of his closest friends. I had a close friend, and I never knew it. And where the fuck is Darla? She couldn't take off one afternoon to come and pay her respects to a man she wrote 51 fucking idiotic letters to? A heart over every eye? was so important, she couldn't take the time off to come and give this man a proper send-off. She better be dead. You know, I really don't understand. How is it a decent guy, a guy who worked his ass off his entire life, how is it he could barely afford to sublet the corner of my shithole apartment? I mean, he never caught a break. He never got ahead. How fucked up is that? And all these fucking horrible assholes in the world that just get shit handed to them. Hey, this guy fought in a war. He traveled. He won a Lindy contest. I didn't know Jackie could dance. Half the time, it didn't seem like he could walk. But there is a first-place ribbon sitting in this fucking weather-beaten, rat-eaten, fucked-up little box that he shoved in a corner. A man's life in a shitty box. A really good man's life. You know, a man who deserved something, and he wound up sprinkling sawdust on vomit at the gaslight. Well, this can't continue, okay? I cannot stand by and watch this happen to another poor slob, so I am dedicating the rest of my miserable fucking life to finding the Jackies of the world. The ones you'll walk by, the ones you don't see, the ones who never catch a break. And I'm gonna make sure that they never, ever end up in my fucking apartment. Oh, and I'm really sorry about this lady. I'm sure she was very nice, too.
I love that. It was so fantastic.
I mean, to me, this is the most emotional part of the show thus far. I mean, season four, the thrust of
no question.
This kind of becomes the rocket fuel underneath Susie to open up her own management company, which she does with the mobster men that previously kidnapped her.
Well done.
And then asks for a cut of her business, and then she's like, yeah, whatever, and doesn't know that she's probably agreed to a very dumb contract. But isn't it interesting, Alice, that the most interesting parts of a season of television can be unplanned deaths that the Paladinos then have to ride in? That's literally not, you know, by force of will of their own narrative storytelling, but by force of God.
The force of God. And so many shows don't handle it that way, but then they take something and make it meaningful within the context of the story we're telling is really, it's really moving. And two things. Do you think that maybe in the world of Hollywood, like old men who work in TV are like, you know, they all kind of speak among themselves and they're like on whatever old men forum they go on. They're like,
Reddit.
If you're going to die, you want to die on a Paladino show because they'll really make a meal out of it. That's the way to go.
Yeah. All character actors over 65 are like, can I get Maisel season 5? I'll do whatever. I'll be a busboy.
Look, I just got a diagnosis.
Oh my God.
It's not good, but I want to go out working.
Yeah.
and Paladino's like, yeah, take a meeting.
Sure, whatever.
And then it also feels like Borstein is like, you think I got all the Emmys? I'm not even getting started.
Just one more for Susie.
Yummy. You know, and that's my category, by the way. I'm nominated. I'm not going to be nominated, but if I were to be
for most yummy,
it would be most yummy supporting actress in a comedy series, which is what Borstein's gunning for. So it felt like a personal attack to me. And
well,
I can't imagine it wasn't.
Alice, you're being, submitted for an Emmy nomination.
Mm.
But I tell you what, you were nominated for a Kevvy for most yummy and you won.
Oh my God.
You won.
Can we have some music?
Yes.
Can
absolutely.
We have some like background music about like, oh, okay. I'm going to do a,
yeah,
a
here
quick
we
acceptance
go.
Speech.
Yeah. Here you
here
go.
We go. Oh my God. This is so moving. And I just wanted to say, thank you. First of all, to the Academy of the Motion, Kevin. It's just Kevin. Thanks to Kevin. And I want to say back home, everybody who said I wasn't going to be able to do that. Is this really the music? Anyway,
yes,
back home,
also,
all those people.
Now, here's what I didn't say. If you want a Kevin,
weird interruption
you have to marry
during
me.
My speech, yeah. But okay. All right.
You're my bride now. Yeah.
Oh my, okay. Oh my God.
So come
you
on.
You know what? Awards shows need to be more. And that's why we need gimmicks on awards shows. So I say I do. To this award. And everybody back home who said I couldn't do it, well, guess what? I put a ring on it. And now I'm trapped in a loveless marriage that I can't get out of. And it's because of my work. So Thank you, God. Woo! Thank you, Jesus Christ. Just Kevin's here. No one else is even at our wedding. Hey, I don't like that.
Well,
but
I want it to be private. I don't want to make a big deal.
All right,
deal
stop interrupting my speech. Anyway, and I want to bring awareness to how this system is rigged against people who don't want to get married. Bye.
Yay. Now, here's the truth of it. If the winners of the Best Actor and Best Actress Oscars had to, at the end of the ceremony, marry each other, people would watch.
Thank you. Like, right. If it was like Love is Blind sponsored it.
And it's like, all right, Frances McDormand, you have to divorce your husband and marry Anthony Hopkins.
It's, if you get nominated and win, it's an immediate divorce.
Yeah, that's
you,
right.
You may or may not say I do and accept the award when you get to the front of the line. If you get to the stage, you've already been divorced. You can't undo that. You got to remarry your partner if you want to. But you have the choice of saying I do to Anthony Hopkins or not.
That would be so good. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my
gracious.
God. I would watch the fuck out of that show.
Well, maybe next year they'll get their act together.
All of this inspired by Borstein's performance.
Yes, absolutely. But that said, I did find it kind of interesting that they devote a whole episode of an 8-episode season to, you know, like I know there's other plots going on and there's other subplots at work, but it is wild that it's like, all right, let's pay our respects. And you know,
right.
The episode ends on a picture of him and the tribute was lovely. I am curious as to how this will relate to Midge's journey. It's just so, it just feels like it's not a part of the deal anymore.
Right. I mean, but there's always been a tension between Midge's journey and Susie's journey.
That's true.
And
yes.
Whose journey is the journey, because it's, you know, it is like in Gilmore Girls, you know, it's, there's the Rory journey and the
Lorelai.
You know, the Lorelai. Oh, you think it's, I thought it was Rory and Dylan. But
Rory and Dylan. I did forget about Dylan. Yeah, that's my bad.
I assumed it was a Rory and Dylan. But yeah, Rory and Lorelai are the, you know, whose journey is the center of that show.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of up for grabs. So in this, are they doing something? We've always thought like, oh, it's a Midge show, but are they doing something where it's like Susie and Midge two-handing it?
But here's what I
Why
find.
Why do you have your passport in your hand?
Because I'm ready to get the hell out of here. No, I always fiddle with something in my hands while I'm recording or on a long call.
What a strange fiddle thing to fiddle with.
Well, it just came in the mail because I might go overseas.
I'm just fiddling with this giant check I got from Publishers Clearinghouse.
Viewers of Gilmore Girls loved Lorelai. Lorelai was a character that meant a lot to them. Mm-hmm. And for a time, I think maybe before the tide sort of turned on her, a lot of people watching that show loved Rory as well. It feels like between the two, the obvious kind of aesthetic comparison would be, oh, Midge Maisel is a sort of Lorelai figure.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, what we're seeing as the show plays out more is she's more of a Rory,
yeah,
in terms of like,
yes,
outing a gay black man in the 60s and then her reaction being, I want revenge for experiencing,
yeah,
a consequence from it. That feels more of like a post-Yale Rory move than it does
because
a Lorelai thing.
Because Rory, like Rory is the up-and-comer and Lorelai is the underdog that we root for because she hasn't had a break, right?
Yeah, and Lorelai's settled too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really Susie's journey. And so like it's all about Susie getting a second chance at life, you know? And that's more like every time I do this podcast, I forget the word. That's more relatable, sociable,
accessible.
No, not accessible.
Empathy, compassionate.
Sympathetic.
Sympathetic.
Than somebody who's like the star is born, you know, newcomer to the scene, mm-hmm, person, and all the trials and, you know, all the mistakes they make, because it's with Midge, it's just nonstop mistakes.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now listen, we're all walking around with a lot. You've heard the term, I've got a lot of baggage. Well, we all have a lot of baggage. We have things that we always need to get off our chest, things that are unexpressed, desires, wants, needs. A lot of those are stressors, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can really start to affect us negatively. And you don't even understand it because you're not tuning into what those things are. But guess what? There's a safe space for you to tune into those things, and it's called therapy. Therapy is where you can figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. I've been working through what's weighing me down for the last 11 years. I'm laughing because now I feel light after working it through. But it's just funny to think, oh yeah, I've been working through it for 11 years. But I gotta tell you something, it's changed and made better pretty much every part of my life, except for maybe dog training. That's still a little hard. Therapy doesn't really have anything to do with that. But as far as my relationships, my work life, communication, and specifically interpersonal stuff and my own relationship with myself, it's been so, so helpful. I do not know how I would have done the last decade plus without therapy. So if you're thinking about starting therapy, maybe give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Gilmore Guys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Gilmore Guys. I think, too, there's got to be some sort of... I'm curious to see what people's relationships will be to these television shows 20 years out from now. So in the 2040s, 2050s, when people look back on their relationship with even something like Friends or Scrubs or Parks and Rec or The Office versus a stream...
Scrubs got in there. Okay.
Well, I'm just thinking of a long-running sitcom with a lot of episodes. Cheers,
Frasier.
Congrats
to Scrubs for making that list.
Everyone, listen to Fake Doctor's Real Friend.
You know,
what are Zach
and- you think of the hits, you know, the I Love Lucy. You've got, you know, Cheers. You've got Parks and Rec. You've got The Office. You've got Wings. You've got shows like, you know, it's like, how the fuck
Wings
did
was a hit. That was on for 9 years.
You know, shows like that you think about. Seinfeld.
With
Kurt,
Shalhoubi.
You know, Coach.
Well, the thing.
Obviously, Roseanne.
The thing I was going to say is that by sheer number of minutes and hours time spent, by the end of season 2 of Gilmore Girls, you've spent more time with those characters. Or by the end of season 3, you've spent more time with those characters than you will ever spend with another character
yeah,
in the center of a
really
1 hour
crazy.
Drama.
Yeah, yeah,
is
yeah,
that crazy? So like,
yeah.
Gilmore was on for 7 years. By the end of Maisel's run and Gilmore's run, don't think of it in terms of seasons 5 to 7. Think about it in terms of minutes and hours. It's like 2 or 3 times as much. I mean, obviously my exact math is off, but in the sense of like people's love for a character, I feel like viewers really
love- Can we
get
the eggheads on that math?
Yeah, get some eggheads in the lab with that. But people love Abe. People really love Susie. I don't know if anyone in the viewership, or I'd be curious in our listenership, really loves Midge in that sense. That the way that you just like fucking are rooting for Susie- You want her to do well. You want her to navigate all the Sophie Lennon bullshit. I don't know if Midge is someone that garners the same sort of sympathy and respect that those other kind of juicier characters do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if people love these characters the same way maybe they've loved, whether it's Gilmore or another show, loved other characters the same way. So then it makes it difficult to kind of play with those tropes when there's less... When there's less that people have attached to it.
Yeah, for sure.
But one thing that people have a lot attached to is the Lenny Bruce, Midge Maisel dynamic. And he pops
really
back in this episode. In 403, she sees him backstage at the strip club, tells her a little parable about keeping focus. And this little speech he gives her about his high school, Belmore, is the title's namesake. It's also a school I found out John Gabris went to for real. John Gabris went to Belmore High on Long Island.
Wow.
But yes. And so as a sort of exercise in a way to sharpen her stand-up skills, Lenny Bruce and some other boys in the audience throw a bunch of shit at her while she's doing a stand-up set in between the dancers at the nightclub. As a stand-up, how did this part of the episode strike you? Alice.
Yeah, not as bad as normal. I mean, she, you know,
not as bad as normal. Compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, the bar is very low for Midge's stand up for sure. I liked that it was material, you know, obviously material she had rehearsed and wasn't going to abandon. And it did strike me as like, okay, if I'm in the audience watching a stand-up not react to having Twizzlers thrown at her, like, that's not something that you would not interact with. You know what I mean? Like, you would absolutely address it.
You would make a meal out of it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. Crazy. But that's not the direction they chose to go. And she handled it. And it was also very sexual to me. Like, it was just very hot.
Well, this is...
Lenny Bruce can throw garbage at me. Lenny Bruce, as played by Luke Kirby, can throw garbage at me.
It is such a funny... This is not a problem I've ever seen on any show in which... This happens all the time, where it's like, this character was only supposed to be in one episode, but guess what? The performance was so good, his chemistry with the lead was so good, that we just had to write him in more.
Yeah.
Now, that's happened on shows all the time. Aaron Paul famously was supposed to die at the end of Breaking Bad season one, but they kept writing for him. Now, the thing that hasn't happened is that also this character is a real life person who did die in the year 1966.
Right.
And so we got to play around with that a little bit and make sure whatever we do with him occurs all before that time, because there's a ticking time bomb to this thing.
Yeah.
And we can't alter the course of, or I mean, they could do whatever they want, but we can't alter the course of history too much to write in a different sort of fate for him. I've never seen that problem on a show before where it's literally, he was a guest star for the first three seasons. He's a series regular.
Yeah.
Which, you know, doesn't mean he has to be in every episode, but it means he's getting paid.
I thought that is what it meant, but I guess not.
No.
He doesn't have to be there.
There's all sorts of weird, funky crediting stuff. Like the guy who played the CEO of Valter in Succession was technically a series regular for seasons one and two. He's in like three episodes. So it's just, there's all sorts of weird, funky crediting going on in all these TV shows. But it definitely doesn't mean that.
It sounds like they had Susie Meyerson for a fucking agent, because that person doesn't have a life besides getting that person ridiculous credits.
I know.
That they don't have to work for.
You know, and shouts out to Kevin Pollak and Caroline Anderson's agents as well. Am I getting her name wrong again? It's Caroline Aaron. I always say Anderson instead of Aaron.
Yeah, you know it would be me to correct you, but I was just being too gracious.
Yeah.
No, I definitely know people's names, for sure.
Thank you for your graciousness. Even more of a struggle to kind of connect it back to the main thrust of the thing is everything happening with Joel. With Joel and May, it's a hard relationship to get invested in. Not because of the performances, which I think are very strong, especially from her, but it does just feel like a little wheel spinning to the point of, well, obviously, this probably isn't going to work out. It feels like the kind of track that they're laying is, you know, Midge is bettering herself in all these ways professionally, definitely not personally or morally. And then Joel is bettering himself in all these ways professionally and maybe a little bit personally. Maybe they're going to better themselves so much that they realize they're actually great for each other. Because in these episodes, once again, they exchange little glances. They clearly still love each other and care for each other.
Yeah.
But it feels like one of those things where all of Joel's business with May and even the tension and they sort of explicitly acknowledge the racial element to how it's different for her to meet his parents than him to meet her parents, etc. But it's hard to really feel your feet planted in it. And with a lot of the plots this season, I think there is a just kind of taking a survey of viewer response, at least anecdotally, there's this sense of malaise of, I don't know if it's the 2-year break between 2019 in this set of episodes, or if it's the weekly release schedule that's maybe frustrating people in a different way. But everyone does seem to have this feeling of, where are we going? What's going to happen in the remaining likely 12 episodes of this show?
Yeah.
The show has 12 episodes left to do what it's going to do. Where are we going? Joanna Robinson from The Ringer has the theory that the show is pointing to Midge having a television career.
Yeah.
That the reason they're setting up the Reed Scott character is that she can, maybe she's going to start competing for the hosting gig that Sophie Lennon, Jane Lynch's character, wants.
Right.
And is going to be a shoo-in for that stuff. I don't know, but it is hard to tell. It's like, we got 12 episodes left. We got to get to Kelly Bishop and Milo Ventimiglia later in this season. We got the whole promise.
What if the last three episodes are just all montage? Three full montage apps.
Well, here's what I was going to ask you. Would you want a time jump.
Yes.
Would you want it to be like, because we're currently in 1960.
Yeah, I love the way this episode, this show handles time jump.
Because mm-hmm.
I feel like we've seen it before. Have we?
Well, no, we haven't quite yet. It's taking place basically in real
time. It's just time jumped in terms of it was 2 years since the last.
Yeah, I think that's literally it. It's
okay, I time jumped.
Because season 4 picks up right where season 3 ends. The only time jump.
I think this show would do well with a time jump for some reason that is so far unknown. But I do think it would be great because then we could fast forward past Lenny Bruce dying and obviously the grief that Midge would have over that. You know, it would be really bad to see. I don't think it would be great to watch Midge, who's so far is kind of a sociopath, grieve, not grieve over Lenny.
Well, here's what I feel like it would be. If they did do a time jump, this is what I was thinking about earlier today, is you pick up season 5, or maybe it's at the end of season 4 even, and they do like an in-season time jump, and they go 6 or 7 years. It's 1960, so fast forward to late 1966, post-Lenny death. She's been grinding it out in the strip club circuit and then rising in that very low stratosphere, but then also doing television stuff and adding to it. And then he kind of becomes her North Star and her Obi-Wan, mm-hmm. even in his death and passing.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah,
the kind
yeah.
of thing in the way that Jackie spurs on Susie's management career. Maybe that spurs on Midge to finally get that Tonight Show slot.
Yeah.
And finally perform there. Because that would be realistic where it's like, oh yeah, you get the Tonight Show after doing 6 years of stand-up.
Yeah.
And doing these gigs. Yeah. And then they get to play with all the 1966 aesthetics as opposed to yeah. just staying in 1960. Yeah. They could do that.
And then we could have Boise come back into the picture because I think they have chemistry and I like that.
Boise, yeah. We'll see what happens.
I like
with
that.
Boise.
It's a meet cute. He's definitely not a sympathetic character in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so we love a transformation arc, right? We also love old Josh. I love old Josh. Yeah,
not
get him
new
back.
Josh. Old Josh.
I like new Josh too, though. So what if they switch them out as well?
Can you imagine if they got the new guy? What's Skylar Astin? That was new Josh.
Those two men are just super, like, those two men are like cosmically linked.
I would love
that. Constantly replace each
old
other.
Old Darren and new Darren, like on Bewitched.
They're just like interchangeable and everybody knows it.
Even though I don't think they are at all. I found Fontana to be better.
That's why it's better.
More charismatic
they're
performer.
Not.
I know. Isn't that interesting? Ooh. I mean, they can both sing, I guess. 404, we see Midge taking a lot of control over the strip club. And this is something Paladinos like to do a lot, which is show us why we should like a character by displaying their hyper competence.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that with Lorelai managing the inn, and this goes there, blah, 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 da, da, da.
And then the audience of extras coming up and going like, this inn is the best inn ever.
We love it. Thank you for letting us stay here.
And it's obviously because of you.
You know, as an extra in that inn, I can attest. That's literally what I said
that's
to her.
That's true. Oh
on
my
shooting
God, that's
day,
right. I forgot.
5 years ago, whenever that was. Yes, so she's kind of displaying that in maybe displaying an inappropriate amount of management there. And then 404 is also when we see the culmination of the FBI plot. I don't know why we're
absolute
doing this, but
like hot garbage. So bad. Just a reason to bring back Jason Alexander, I guess, but it was awful.
There's plenty of reasons to bring him back. I don't know why you got to do it this way.
Oh, baby, there's so many reasons, baby.
So Abe writes his review of the very bad play in the Village Voice. He sort of alludes to a crime that him and Asher did back in the day. So the FBI has to do an interview with them. And then it comes out over dinner conversation the night before the interview. Both Asher and Abe dated Rose. And then for some reason that is not fully explained in the episode, Abe gets super pissed and jealous and bitter about it and then takes it out via the FBI and being a narc to the
And they're just not going to explain it, you can tell. And like, Abe is not a jealous person, never known him to be irrational about stuff like this. And then even further making, like, what do you call it when we call it the Loganing? Oh, who's the
deaning?
The deaning.
We call it
the deaning. The deaning of Abe.
Yes.
The deaning of Abe. The royal deaning.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all of a sudden he's like, not only is he a jealous asshole, but he's like, blames Rose. He's like, look, I know I never listened to you, but you didn't tell me. So he blames her and also says why it is his own fault in the blaming. And it's just like, okay, this guy is the worst person. Like, and that's not the person we know at all. Completely unearned turn of character. And it just sucks. Like, I hated it. It was awful.
I'm gonna
did make Jason Alexander more fuckable.
I mean, they can't not make him fuckable, to use what it sounds like.
It's tough. It's a tough row to hoe.
So I hate to keep using this as the standard of comparison, but it's just what I was reading the most about in the last year, year and a half since it was off TV. But in the writer's room of Succession, they had a rule that whatever sort of erudite or wordy insult that a character would lob at another character, the insult could never be more intelligent than that specific character was. So if it's, you know, Kendall insulting Shiv, what he says can't be smarter than who Kendall actually is. They can't just like take it from a list of 20 insults and then just throw it to Kendall or you know, make his interchangeable with Cousin Greg. And that's a particular way of writing a show. I think that's mostly successful in that show. On Maisel, it is more of an old-fashioned sitcom sensibility in which there's no sense of character you won't sacrifice for a particular joke.
Right.
So in the way where it's like, yeah, Abe's just like a jealous, masculine, weirdo guy. Or in the, I'm reminded in 403, too, when they have the dynamic with Susie when she accompanies Rose to her matchmaking thing. Mm-hmm. And the clear setup is Susie's like a little kid.
Yeah.
And Rose is like her parent.
Yeah.
And Susie just says a bunch of stuff. Susie, even in grief, probably wouldn't say because it's like, no, but that's the joke. She's right. A little kid. She's like, I want to go home. I need a coloring book.
Yeah.
And that's a style I don't generally love.
Right.
So that was less.
Yeah. And I don't know that there's a way to do those jokes without sacrificing character, you know, because they're just really broad jokes that are real. They're cartoon jokes from a Hanna-Barbera show. So
yeah. And also
thank you Dan.
Yay, Poopy. You can tell Dan did not write that speech at the funeral, by the way, because there was no poop or vomit jokes in it.
Yeah. Dan was deer in the headlights during that whole thing. He's like, she's sad though.
We are not necessarily the most qualified people to talk about this aspect of it, but of course the episode Interesting People on Christopher Street is an allusion to the queer community in New York. And if you know about New York history, you know that, of course, Stonewall was on Christopher Street. And literally, if you hang out on Christopher Street long enough, you will run into John Waters. So that part of the show was accurate.
He's the Chris Noth of Christopher Street.
Well, hopefully not fully, as far as what happened with Chris Noth. But
and then Midge does run into him.
And she does, because she's looking for what? She's looking for a lesbian bar to take Susie to. Mm-hmm. So the show is finally explicitly acknowledging, wait, is Susie gay? What's her romantic life like? And Midge's approach to doing so is maybe equally as tactless as the Paladino's approach to doing so as well.
No, I would say it could be worse.
It definitely could be worse.
I would say it could be worse. And it wasn't like a relief, because it's definitely too little too late for sure. Because we've been, you know, dancing around it for... So what are they going to do, right? Is it's like the character is asexual? We still don't know. And I like that they just are like... So is there like a don't ask, don't tell policy in the writers?
Yeah, to themselves. It's like, until Susie tells us what she is, we're not going to ask her what she is.
But it is interesting. There is one angle to look at it, like Midge's insensitivity and Midge's projection. Like, I don't want you to be alone. Like, my needs above yours.
Yeah.
You know, like, I need to see that you're okay, because my version, what I think okay is, means partnered up. And that, and Susie being the character you root for in that dynamic, being like, you don't get to say what my version of happy looks like.
I have a clip of that too, if you want to take a listen.
Yeah.
Let's get a drink. Done. Stupid, you. I have to say, I'm... Okay, fuck it. I'm excited. There, I said it. Eat me, I'm excited. What is this?
It's new.
Did you... What? Did you bring me to a lesbian bar?
Fun, huh?
What the fuck?
What the fuck what?
I just said eat me really loud.
Are you upset?
Why would you do this?
I just thought I'd try. I mean, I never know.
You never talk about yourself.
It's because it's none of your business.
Yeah, but we're together all the time, and I just thought I'd try. I don't care.
What?
I just want you to know, I don't care.
You don't?
No. I am totally comfortable with you being whatever it is you want to be.
Well, thank you very much for your permission.
I didn't mean...
May I go to the bathroom? Do I need a note from my mother to get out of gym class?
I just meant you can tell me anything.
Jesus Christ, Miriam. How did you even know about this place? Would you hang out on Christopher Street asking guys with carnations in their lapels where to find a butch bar?
No. I was not that specific.
Would you think you'd bring me here? I'd look around and just dive in?
I wanted to give you the option. I didn't have a plan. I just thought we'd hang out, check out the scene.
Scene? This is the village. I live here. You think I don't know how to find a lesbian bar? There are three within rock-throwing distance. Two doors down, there's guys sticking their fists up each other's asses. This is my town. I know everything.
You are always alone. Always.
So the fuck what?
I don't want you to be alone.
Let me worry about that.
I want you to be happy.
Oh. Great. Pay for my drink.
Susie.
I am focused on one thing right now. Susie Meyerson and Associates. That's it. Being your manager. Not just your manager. Being a manager. The manager. Do you understand?
Yeah.
But I got a fucking view!
She's referring to her view from the office. So, to their credit, what I enjoy about this scene is that it's sort of the manifestation of infographics we've all seen the last 2 years, which is how to be a bad ally. Where it's like, obviously Midge means well, she fucking loves Susie. She thinks she's doing a nice thing for her, but it turns out what she's doing is a little insensitive, indelicate. She's going about it all the wrong ways. And to the show's credit, and to the credit of Amy and Dan,
yeah,
they do sort of contextualize that properly by Susie being like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
By, you know, giving all this to me.
This reminded me of this scene. Can you enable screen sharing for
sure.
me?
Sure.
Real quick. All right. So this is a scene from The Simpsons.
Okay.
Wait a minute. There's something bothering me about this place. I know. This lesbian bar doesn't have a fire exit.
That's very funny. This lesbian bar doesn't have a fire exit.
That was Susie in this scene.
Yes, and
when she realized where they were.
They wrote it with enough wiggle room where she doesn't say, well, of course I'm gay. I just don't want to be with anyone right now.
Right.
But they also didn't do, I'm asexual. And obviously, I don't even know if they would, you know, if a Susie type would have that vocabulary in 1960.
Right.
But it's still giving them enough room to play where it's like, it's neither here nor there. And maybe they are planting the seed for something else to grow later in the season.
Maybe, but there could also be, I could also see it as like Amy and Dan, or Amy being like, I guess because we know she kind of doesn't pay attention to response to her characters. But like if she did, there would be or maybe writers having this, somebody voicing to her and her reaction being like, here's the scene where I tell you it's none of your fucking business. Yeah, that's not part of this character's arc. And so fuck off. Don't ask that question.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know,
I'm so curious as to what it'll eventually be.
Me too.
But I was very intrigued by how it played out. And again, I would love for there to be more scenes like this. Where the kind of thing that I think we struggled with a little bit in the first two episodes was, how aware is the show of the fact that Midge's response to the Shy Baldwin fiasco is to want revenge is bananas? How aware is the show of that? So to have a sort of POV character say like, obviously this is stupid what you've done, is like really helpful.
Yeah.
Because you just kind of don't know the arc that you're supposed to be going on. Again, it's not about
shit. But then it's like if Sterling K. fucking Brown couldn't communicate that to Midge and the audience, then to me it's like all hope is lost, you know, for Midge understanding that.
Can Milo Ventimiglia? We'll find out.
Oh my God. Like, why can't she understand this on any level? And it's a big, yeah, it's a huge problem going forward in this season. This person is just like fundamentally misunderstanding like her effect on the world and like what, like the ideas of right and wrong. It just like really rubs with like being able to even root for her as an anti-hero. Cause it's like an anti-hero would at least have some understanding and then either remorse or not remorse, but she just doesn't get it at all. Really? Like, what an idiot.
And that's, you just want a little bit of an arc rather than a stasis. Cause even
an
Rory.
Arc, yes.
Yeah. Cause Rory Gilmore has an arc on Gilmore.
Yeah.
And it might be an anti-hero arc, but in the sense of shedding good girl aesthetics as well as behavior over time and embracing authentic sort of life that she wants for herself.
Yeah.
That's an arc. I feel like Lorelai doesn't really have an arc though, if you think about it, for that show.
Yeah.
The arc should be her accepting and love and communicating better with Emily.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what they're getting at, but it seems a little too circular. But with this, it's the only thing that has changed in four seasons is Midge is, as it pertains to the world of the show, better at stand-up. She is coming into her powers. She's more of a pro at this. She garners the respect of peers like Lenny Bruce, etc. But as far as her personal life, how she treats people,
how
she communicates with her family, which is all but anonymous as far as her kids go, there's not that much in terms of movement. But there is movement with Susie. Susie is more of a prick when the show starts, and now she's like opened herself a little bit up more to love and respect and that special thing that her and Miriam share. And in even with other people, you can see like her opening herself up to love, even in the Jackie funeral scene.
Yeah.
But as far as Midge goes, it's like, and it'd be a different thing if it's like to get to where she needed to be in her community and in her profession, she had to shed a lot of what she held dear and precious in her life. She had to be a shittier mom. She couldn't be a good partner to someone. And then show that. She had to be more ruthless.
Yeah.
But it's not even doing that, too. So
it's not even doing that. Yeah,
I'm a
exactly.
little puzzled by it.
Puzzled.
Curious to see where it goes. Alice, you wanted to do a little Twitter Q&A?
Tweet, tweet.
Tweet, tweet.
Once again, listeners, thank you for coming in with the best questions. Annie writes in, who do you think writes a harsher review, Abe or Rory? And of course, I got to go with my man, Abe, because Abe is simply better at the game than Rory is. Abe knows how to do a pan. Rory is fumbling her way through the dark.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to say experience is going to win out in this case, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the voice is, you know, the Fakukta paper of all Fakukta's paper. I wouldn't say the Yale review is going to be the place where I go to read a review.
No, I don't think
so. Of a theater production, for God's sake.
Abby says, why do none of Midge's hats actually match her outfit? Even Susie calls it out. Is this a metaphor for something? Now, did you notice this, Alice, during these last two episodes, how kind of avant-garde in parts that the hat pairing with the outfits were in some ways?
That's super interesting. And I wonder if it is a metaphor or just like whoever's on costumes, like the style of the time became more avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
you know, moving from the 50s to 60s.
I believe there's a whole book about the costumes of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel that was put out by the...
Text only?
It's text only. It's like, and then imagine it looks like this.
Dense too. Small print.
No. Okay. It was Donna Zakowska. Donna Zakowska? Donna Zakowska? We got to get her on the line. But yeah, I believe they put out a little book of the costumes and production design from the show. Heidi says, why are the Paladinos so weird about all things queer? The whole Christopher Street sequence was excruciating. I was embarrassed for every actor involved. I mean, I get it. I definitely get it. And it does feel like you don't want to give someone points in 2022 for finally, you know, wrestling with and doing business with the queer community at all. Finally, they explicitly address something in one of their main cast characters.
Yeah.
But that said, I found the awkwardness to be a feature of it, not a bug. And it kind of reflected how Midge was awkward about it, too. It is my take on it.
Yeah. Maybe there's hope is the take. I don't know. It's weird because it does feel like it's one of those things where it's like the ASP universe is such a queer universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's so much camp in her world that it's like, why is she so bad with this stuff? And it's like, maybe that's because she exists in camp and can't like really fumble around with reality that much. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. She cites the story of having the fight with the WB back in the year 2000, in the year of our Lord, 2000, 2001, about keeping an Oscar Levant reference in the script. And the WB said, no one is going to get that reference. And she said the thing that she thought and rebut them with was like, yeah, maybe no one will get it, but some gay kid in Ohio is going to get it and feel really seen by it. That's the version of the story that she tells. Is like, yeah, this is a niche interest reference, but it'll be for someone. And she specifically said a gay kid. So she is aware. It's such a salient point where it's like her storytelling is so queer aesthetically in nature, but then her absolute sort of awkward approach with all that stuff or disinterest in handling it too much is fascinating. The book, by the way, is Madly Marvelous, The Costumes of the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel by Donna Zakowska. Definitely worth a flip through in your local independent bookstore.
Or library.
Or your library. Next question comes from Brett, but he says, Alice/Brett asked as a reference to our last episode, is the repetition within bits as exhausting to you as it is to me? How many stiffs do you need to tell you you're not a cop before you find John Waters? I find that Paladino bits could use the rule of Coco Chanel. Assemble it, then take something off. I think that's a little bit of Family Guy influence and residue left over. And just like kind of the thing we've been pointing to a lot in this conversation, which is they're old.
Yeah.
They're in their 50s and they come from an older school of sitcom storytelling. And so,
yeah, but like if you're going to enter the warm rose petal bath of Amy Sherman Palladino show, you need to be okay with hanging out with theater kids for a good hour. That's what you need to be okay with. If you're not okay with that, you're not going to like it. End of story. To me, and theater kid bits are always go on too long. They are, nobody knows how to kill a comedic run like a theater kid, you know, and like a little bit too pleased with itself at all times, right? That's just the vibe. That's just the vibe. And like, you know, and my argument for it is always a gay kid in Ohio. It's like Amy Sherman Palladino's running for something.
Isn't that so funny? And a gay kid in Ohio one day.
And this gay kid in Ohio will be seen by my absolute lack of fortitude in representing queer characters except for one time on the WB in 2001.
Gracious. Man. But overall,
I rewatched that Pokemon Go to the Polls thing recently and I'm like, wow. I don't understand how she got as far as she did politically.
You don't?
Like hugely into Hillary, but I like a total, not a stan, but like very accomplished career. But like Jesus, that was abominably bad.
I got a pop culture plug for you, Alice. There's a 4-part documentary series on Hulu called Hillary. And it tracks her 2016 campaign and then her rise to power before then. But the thing is, it is so in-house produced. It's so hagiographical that literally every flaw that's acknowledged is followed up by 6 talking heads, all of whom used to work on the campaign saying, well, Hillary had to do that because the pressures were
not satisfying to me.
It's so funny. Well, it's just so like there's no dissenting voice in the documentary. It's such a puffy fucking 4-hour little romp of like, and then I was awesome.
And that to me is the whole problem with the whole thing. It's like that's the whole problem with the character, the persona, and like the likability problem. You know, yes, there's misogyny, but there's also this problem where you guys can't acknowledge any amount of like fallibility with your person. And it reminds me of the Kendall Roy, the guy who plays Kendall, had that piece published in
Jeremy
New
Strong
Yorker,
in the New Yorker. Jeremy Strong can't.
And everybody, all these celebrities came forward like, he's actually really great. And it's like, yeah, this isn't helping.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we all read a thing that presented like a real person doing real stuff in the world, some of which was good, some of which was bad, some of which was mildly annoying. And it really created a like an in-depth sort of like textured portrait of this moment culturally and this person existing in this moment. And it was a fucking refresh.
Now imagine this exact same profile was written about the kid who plays Ethan. It's like he has to get into a zone before he goes on.
And
that
Ethan's
set.
Like, you want to come with me to the Lego store?
Oh, man. All right. Well, Alice, we're halfway through the season. Four episodes in, four to go, crazy. Two more episodes of our podcast stupid. To go. Isn't it funny?
Crazy, it's, stupid love.
It's a funny little breeze to do it this way, but I really enjoy the approach we're taking this time around.
I enjoy you.
I enjoy you, and I love you so much. What do you hope to see from the second half of the season? Maybe a little more Lenny flirtation.
I guess a time jump would be nice.
Okay, and, time jump.
Yeah, and I think May, I would like them to really dig it. Like, I'd like to see what happens with the reaction of Joel's parents and maybe the entire family writ large to May's being Chinese and what that looks like and how they handled it, just because I think it's going to be crazy either way. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I think there's going to be consequences for her doing better and better at the strip club with Boise, and I want to see what those are.
Yeah, I'm with you in that I want to see a humbling of Midge in some way, because you did think that's what the end of season three was, is finally this
They're
woman...
literally throwing her off a stage.
Yeah.
Like, to try to humble her, because they can sense it, that she needs to be humbled.
I think that might be where it's headed, and that's exciting.
I agree.
To me.
I think that they're, like, showing, they're like, no, we get it. Like, she's, you know.
And here's what I'll say, that after this conversation, because we're recording this the Friday before it comes out, but this is March 4th that we're recording this. There's two new episodes out we haven't watched yet.
I know.
And I kind of want to watch them now, like, just to...
I do, too.
To see
I
what
do
happens.
Too. Baby, I'm thirsty, and I'm there for you.
Which is not what I thought after the first two episodes of this season. But I'm like, okay, let's go.
Same TBH.
So, Alice, people can follow you at Alice Wetterlin everywhere. They can watch Resident Alien. They can follow me at Kevin T. Porter everywhere. And, subscribe to my onlyfans.com/KevinT.Porter.
And please, if you have the time to also subscribe to another thing, please subscribe to my Mostly Fans.
Mostly Fans, yes. And let's go out with the song that ends this episode by Jonathan Richman. Now, I don't know if you'll know how they chose this song, but the song is called I Was Dancing in the Lesbian Bar.
Well, I was dancing at a nightclub one Friday.
I actually like Jonathan Richman a lot. I recommend his music.
I think he's great. I've always liked him.
I've actually always liked him.
Yeah, I've always liked him. And I knew about him probably before you did, so.
I knew about him 10 years ago, and I'm his dad.
Oh, only 10 years? So you're kind of new to him, unlike me, who knew sooner than that.
All right, we'll see you next week for episodes 405 and 406. I love you. We love you.
It's going to be a party.
Goodbye.
We love you. Bye, little cuties.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.